Each summer, one film opens that you've never heard of and that you will never forget. Nightmares is this year's sleeper.
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Insert your coins and gird your loins, junkies. It's time for another Junk Food Cinema right here on FilmSchoolRejects.com. This is the weekly cult and exploitation film cast that is so good, it just has to be fattening. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and I am joined, as per usual, by my friend and co-host. He is a novelist, he is a screenwriter on such films as Sinister and the upcoming Marvel's Doctor Strange, Lieutenant C. Robert Cargill of Megaforce.
Hi.
How's it going?
It's going good. It's going good. We're digging deep into an 80s cult gem today. So
oh, yes, we
are. I always love it when we do that.
Oh, yes, we are, folks. If you would like to hear us dig into other servings of delightful gems from days past, you can always check out our back catalog of episodes on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema or like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/, you guessed it, Junk Food Cinema. Well, it's an old adage that I used to believe was created for my hometown of Indianapolis, but I hear everywhere now, so I think the adage just sticks no matter where you're from, of if you don't like the weather, just wait 5 minutes.
And it'll change.
And it'll change.
Everywhere in the world says that about where they live.
Yeah.
Except Los Angeles.
Except Los Angeles. But, you know, that's kind of
where, oddly enough, this movie is entirely set.
Mostly. Yeah, that's kind of the thing I love about anthology horror films, is that if you don't like one segment, if you don't like where the film is going, just wait 5 minutes, and sometimes it'll drastically change.
Oh, yeah.
And this week's entry is a 1983 anthology film called Nightmares.
Somewhere between the real and the unreal, between the world of daylight and the dark of night, between the peaceful sleep of dreams and the endless sleep of death, lies the realm of nightmares.
And if any film changes course at the drop of about every 5 minutes, it's Nightmares.
It is. So Nightmares is one of those films, if you grew up in the 80s, invariably, you saw this film like a dozen times. This was one of those movies that for some reason ended up as the Saturday afternoon and Sunday afternoon matinee movie that would be shown on whatever your local off-brand local station was. You know, it wasn't the ABC, NBC, CBS. It wasn't a network. It was whatever your local station was that showed all the syndicated shows. Well, that channel showed this movie so much. It was practically Beastmaster. Like, I mean, and I'm not kidding.
We're approaching Beastmaster levels of replay, folks.
That's what we're talking. Yes, that's exactly what we're talking about. We're talking about, like, it would be, you know, this Saturday at noon, Battle Beyond the Stars, followed by Nightmares, and then Dirty Harry at 4. Stay tuned for the 11:05 movie tonight, Beverly Hills Cop. This was one of those movies. And so I saw this repeatedly. And because it's an anthology film, you'd invariably turn on the TV after you got back from the arcade or going off and doing whatever you would on a Saturday or Sunday. And it would be halfway through the movie and you'd just be in one of the segments and then you'd just kind of watch it on through.
Yeah. So, and that's, again, what I love so much about anthologies, good, bad, in between, is that they present the best opportunity for something great to be gleaned out of even the most unlikely of circumstances. There are so many even terrible anthology films that still have one kernel of something great in them because there's just so much going on and there's so many shifts and there's so many, like, breakneck changes in setups that inevitably something good will come of it. And I think that while there are plenty of things to point out in Nightmares that go, you know, that's not really working for me. At the same time, the scales are completely balanced by the number of things that you see and you're completely captivated by, or that just really, really work on some level. And that's what's great about Nightmares.
Yeah, Nightmares is essentially, it is an anthology film with nothing tying them together.
Not a single thing.
There's a few little things that like get mentioned in each one that you can kind of tie together, and maybe somebody had some kind of thought to, let's make a reference that kind of also is referenced over here. You would think each movie would be about a nightmare in some way, shape, or form,
yeah.
Or you'd have nightmares be part of it. Nightmares get mentioned in two of them, mm-hmm. So you'd think, where were they in the other two? But the thing about that holds this together is that they're four very cool, interesting, short horror stories that would never work as an expanded film.
No.
That they are just, they are perfect at the length they're at.
Yeah. And it's funny you say that, because this film began life as proposed entries for an anthology series on television. And the crazy thing about it is, as you watch this, there's nothing too graphic, too gory, too, too extreme for television. And yet the very reason that they added material and expanded this out for a feature length release is that it was deemed too intense for television. So it is true that this film began life as four entries into a television anthology series, and it was deemed too intense, and then they stretched it out for a feature,
which is weird because it literally predates far more intense television by like 5 years.
Yeah,
like the slasher films that we have often talked about on this show evolved into television in the 80s in a very weird way, in which
as anthologies,
but not all anthologies. Like, we had some like Freddy's Nightmares
or Friday the 13th the series,
which was kind of an anthology. It was kind of X-Files-y before X-Files. It had a plot, it had regular characters, but essentially it was set up to be kind of a horror anthology.
An uber monster of the week type of setup, yeah.
Yeah, and then of course you had shows like Monsters.
Yes.
So, you know, you had all of this intense stuff, and none of this quite touches that level of intensity, but all of this is well-crafted and well-thought-out. That's what I like about Nightmares. That's what always stuck with me, is there's one story in this in particular that stuck with me for a quite long time. And I'd forgotten which other ones were in this because there were so many anthology films that I saw through this period that you forget which movie had which thing. And it's like, oh God, yes, the Bishop in Battle is in this one.
Yes.
And it was so much fun to go back through again. But these stories are all cool and they're all good. And the only thing that really kind of ties them all together is they're all morality plays.
They are this weird, I think as we were watching this, the thing that kind of struck me is like, I think I found the unifying tie between all of these segments, and it's this weird like attempt to uphold conservative values. This is an anthology that's very much make sure you hold fast to your religious faith. Very much video games are evil.
Video games are evil.
Very much make sure that you are a good head of the household as a father, or you invite peril upon your family. The one thing that doesn't quite add up for that is anti-smoking.
Well,
I'm like, I don't really consider.
Smoking is bad. Video games are bad. Losing your faith is bad. Being cheap is bad.
Yeah. So it's a very specific type of conservative value set.
It's all very finger wagging.
Yeah.
of the early 80s. And it's such. And the thing is it's really kind of funny because you watch it and there are some characters in this movie that are such baby boomers. It is unreal.
For
that,
sure.
It's just like, oh yeah, these characters only existed in this era without being hated or mocked.
Mm-hmm.
There's two characters in this movie that I just turn to you and I'm like, I hate both of these fucking people.
I kind of hope they both die.
And you're kind of rooting for them to get it because you just, oh, they both irritate you. And you're not supposed to be irritated by both of them, and you can tell that, but it was a different time.
Yeah.
And so you're supposed to bond to one of those characters, and you don't. And it's, but it's very interesting because all of these ideas are cool.
Very much so. And talk about a mixed bag. Director Joseph Sargent, the director of Nightmares, has had a mixed bag of a career.
Oh, yeah.
He is responsible for one of my favorite movies of the 70s, which is The Taking of Pelham 123.
Which is a great fucking movie. Which, for, by the way, small piece of trivia for those that don't know, The Taking of Pelham 123, the names of the characters in that were lifted by a young man named Quentin Tarantino and given to the characters in Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah. Yeah, between Taking of Pelham 123 and Kansas City Confidential and the John Woo film City on Fire. Was it John Woo?
It was
a Hong Kong film, yeah, called City on Fire. You mix those three films together, and what comes out of that cinematic Cuisinart is Reservoir Dogs. But as far as the varied career of Joseph Sargent, after you have movies like The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3, then prior to that, actually White Lightning, which is probably my favorite of the Hicksploitation era of films. It's, you know, the moonshine running films of Burt Reynolds.
Oh, you know, we haven't done this in a while, so take a drink if you need to. We really need to do a Hicksploitation
movie. Oh, we definitely
need to. We have not covered enough Hicksploitation
on
this
show. We need to do a show about the glories of Burt Reynolds, about the glories of Joe Don Baker, about the glories of Bo Svenson. Yes, these are things that need to be covered.
No. All that needs to fucking happen.
Absolutely. But then as you start going forward along the timeline of Joseph Sargent, you get films like Jaws, The Revenge. So,
which gave me my favorite Michael Caine quote of all time,
which is, of course,
I've never seen Jaws the Revenge, although from what I hear, it's bloody awful. What I have seen is the house that it paid for, and that's bloody magnificent.
Well, there you have it. So, yeah, a mixed bag for sure, which kind of, again, complements the nature of most anthology films in general. But I have a question for you, Cargill. How should we dissect Nightmare? Should we go in the order that the vignettes come?
Absolutely. Okay. Let's go vignette to vignette.
We'll go vignette to vignette. The first one being Terror in Topanga, which has nothing to do with the hot chick from Boy Meets World. I'm sorry to say for those of you who might be confused.
Can we call a 13-year-old girl a hot chick?
When you were 10 when that show was on, you absolutely can.
Okay, so
I have the anti-perv card, the get-out-of-perv-free card.
So the 7-year-old girl that's in this movie, since she was born within months of me, I can refer to her as the hot chick in the fourth segment?
Yes. That is how I don't make the rules. That is law according to the internet. Okay.
No, it's totally cool for me to find her attractive. We were the same age when this movie came out.
Right. No, I'm not saying that I find the young version of her attractive now. The point is, I'm not a pervert.
The point is
the
segment
point.
Is called Terror in Topanga.
Terror in Topanga, which is the most basic of the storylines, in so much as it's exactly that urban legend you have heard 100 times. So familiar is this urban legend that it actually ends up as a segment in the film Urban Legend, about there's a killer on the loose. The woman pulls into the gas station. The gas station clerk is really creepy. She runs away from him only to find out that he was trying to warn her about the actual killer in the back seat. Well, this takes that and adds to it. This is like if that story was brought to you by the American Cancer Society, because in this segment, the reason the woman is out, this is not a teenager out making out with her boyfriend. This is a middle-aged married woman who just needs a pack of goddamn smokes.
She's out of cigarettes. It's 11 o'clock at night. She's going to run to the store. Her husband begs her not to go. There's a killer on the loose. A sheriff's deputy has just been murdered. And don't go out. And she's, okay, honey, I won't go out. And he goes upstairs and she fucking leaves to go buy cigarettes. And and it's a whole big morality play about how your addictions, which is, you know, a theme of the next one as well.
But then stop short halfway through.
Yeah. Can consume you. And then, of course, it's interesting What's interesting about this one is this is the one that is the most paced, like the and most designed like so many of the slasher films of this era. This came out in 83, of course, 2 years after the great slasher boom of 1981, which we have not mentioned in a while, but we used to talk about quite a bit. So for those of you that have come along in 1981, there was slasher films have been so popular in 1980. There was almost a slasher film a week that was released by major studios in 1981. So this is where the slasher film starting to wind down. And this segment is done exactly like a slasher film, where it's all very much creeping very slowly through the dark. This time in a car rather than out in the woods, not finding gas stations open, scary music plays, and you wonder if at any moment the killer is going to jump out.
And while we are going along with that, I want to say that my favorite part of this, this is my least favorite of the vignettes. However, it has an opening to it that I think is really spectacular in the way it defies expectations. It is a police officer talking on his CB radio. You understand that there is a killer on the loose. You get the impression something bad is going to happen to this cop. That's not the moment that defies expectation for me. What does defy expectation is when the cop turns his back and the killer kind of comes upon him, the killer makes a lot of noise, a lot of screaming, very unsettling, shrill noises. But as the cop is being stabbed, he makes no noise at all. It's this. It makes the scene all the more uncomfortable that there isn't that release. And as this cop is stabbed repeatedly, he doesn't really make a sound. And it's almost as if he never had the chance to and isn't getting that. And as the audience, we're not getting that release either. So it just kind of builds up even more as he's falling to the ground. And it's very, it's all the more grisly for the fact that the cop isn't screaming in pain.
Yeah.
And the way he falls, and it's just kind of this desperate attempt to grab on anything. He grabs the antenna of the car, which obviously is not structurally sound enough to keep him upright. So he kind of slowly falls to the ground, and the antenna just kind of wags back and forth. And it's really well done. And it is really off-putting and so... that in and of itself is enough to give you nightmares. And the rest of the... The rest of the segment plays out, like I said, like that urban legend, and we get to the actual gas station where the there's one of the things we're going to talk about with this movie is that it is lousy with character actors. There are character actors all over this film.
Oh, you recognize you fucking trip over them.
Yeah,
you know, like so much so that there's character actors that weren't character actors yet that would that are. Playing characters in the arcade segment in the second segment, where it's just here's a bunch of kids who are going to grow up to be character actors. Like this thing is just it is scattershot. It's like let's load up a shotgun with character actors and fire. And you will recognize most of them when you see them. You'll be like, oh, it's that guy. Oh, it's that lady.
William Sanderson is the one I'm particularly thinking about at the end of this particular vignette.
There's a handful of these, though, that you're just like, oh, I love this dude. And then, of course, there's a third segment, which is, one of the great character actors of our time. But
we'll
get there in the third segment.
So she pulls into a gas station. She's hurrying home with her cigarettes, and she's almost out of gas. She pulls into a gas station where a creepy attendant, played by William Sanderson, who you guys might remember from, you know, Last Man Standing, Blade Runner. He's also, if you've ever seen the show Newhart, he's, hi, I'm Larry. This is my brother, Daryl, my other brother, Daryl.
Deadwood,
of course. There's this great moment where she's still in the car. She asked him for $5 worth of gas, which you pointed out in the 80s meant fill her up. And he all of a sudden smashes the window with the, now at this point, it should be pointed out, we don't know what the actual killer looks like. They've done a pretty good job throughout the course of this vignette of describing the killer without actually giving us a good look at him, like through police reports on TV and so on and so forth. So when he smashes that window, you immediately think, oh, he's the one they've been after. And he drags her out of the car, and it looks kind of brutal. And the next thing you know, she's fallen down, and he's pulled a gun out, and she's cowering, and he shoots a man who emerges from the backseat of her car wielding a knife, played by Li Ving, who many of you will know either as Mr. Body from the movie Clue or as the lead singer of the punk band Fear. So, again, character actors literally just show up to die in this movie, just like, hey, gone. And so that's the first segment. And again, I think it's the weakest just because there's not a lot to it other than its anti-smoking agenda. I mean,
the thing about the first one is it's all style over substance. It is a punchline story. It's all about the big twist at the end. It's all about misdirection. And there's very little character and very little story. It's just well executed.
I would agree.
But what makes this the weakest is the remaining three things are all supernatural stories with very cool concepts.
Yeah.
This doesn't have a cool concept, and thus the magic of it doesn't quite connect in the way the others do.
But I think what does connect all these vignettes, and I just thought of it as we were talking about this, is apart from conservative values, is plagiarism. Because all of these vignettes in some way borrow liberally to the point of a little bit plagiarized from things you've seen prior to this.
Plagiarismo.
In this case, they are wholesale ripping off a very popular urban legend. That's fine. No big deal. Those things get recycled. I mean, the morality play, urban legend being funneled through sort of the centrifuge of horror is kind of where we get slasher films in the first place. So that makes sense to me. The second vignette we're going to talk about, which is called, of course, the Bishop of Battle.
I am the Bishop of Battle, master of all I survey.
Is probably how this film is best remembered. It's the one that probably gets the most attention when people remember back to the movie Nightmares.
Well, it's got the biggest star in this movie.
And also the most expensive special effects. In fact, the effects in this vignette were so costly, they almost bankrupted the entire production. So, yeah, this is definitely the one that I think gets the most attention. But this is the story of J.J. Cooney, played by Emilio Estevez. And he is a video game hustler. So he actually goes to arcades with his little confederate, and they pretend to be bad at games, get the stakes of the pay for play going up and up until, oh, surprise, I'm really good at video games. And
his little friend being a child character actor of the era who folks my age will remember as the best friend on Parker Lewis Can't Lose.
Billy Jane is the name of the actor. Who in this film plays Zach Maxwell, who sounds like the bad guy.
I think it was supposed to be Zach.
But it came out Zach.
It's written Zach.
The mom definitely says Zach at one point. Because I was like, what is she saying? Zach? I don't understand. And then I looked it up on IMDb and I was like, oh, Zach. That kid's name is literally Zach. Like he sounds like someone who should be going up against Jared Zinn with a name like Zach Maxwell.
It's probably a whole play on, since this segment is about video games and is written by someone who doesn't seem to know much about video games.
But does seem to know enough about them to hate them.
Yeah. It sounds like, what would the kid who played video games be called? Oh, he'd be called Zach. He would have changed his name to a video game name. Yeah.
But J.J. Cooney, played by Estevez, has two obsessions. One is this arcade game called The Bishop of Battle, which has 13 progressively harder levels, and it's the game no one can seem to beat. And people who, there are urban myths about people in other towns that have beaten this game, that have reached this mythic.
A guy up in Jersey has reached the 13th level twice.
Yeah, and so he just wants to beat this game, His other obsession, having Ellen DeGeneres' haircut, but that's really not germane to the plot. He just really happens to look a lot like Ellen DeGeneres in this movie.
He has his moments of degenerousness.
he's basically just a degenerous in this film.
Hey, I found Dory. We canceled the movie.
I am the Bishop of Nemo. So he gets to the point where he can't wait until the arcade opens the next day. He breaks in and he takes on the game where he does reach the 13th level, only to discover that brings the elements from the game into the real world, where he has to then fight them off with a with the gun from the game, and that he's basically playing in real life to disastrous consequences.
Of course, now what we skipped over was his teenage life is apparently falling apart. His grades are terrible. He and his family don't get along. You know, even his friend is somebody that is hanging around to make money. But does seem to care about him. But
yes.
He's just this kid that's so obsessed with video games, his life is going nowhere and he's destroying himself.
And one of the ways they underscore that is actually what I thought this was funny, this weird connective tissue between the first two segments, is that he's listening to music by the band Fear that Lee Ving is the lead singer of. Oddly, the very next year, after in 1984, Emilio Estevez would star in Repo Man, which... His character and the home life of his character in this vignette of Nightmares is oddly similar to how his home life is portrayed in the movie Repo Man. So much so that I was like, wait, which one came out first? Is this a nod to that? Turns out, no, Nightmares came out first. And then the very next year, he would play a character with almost the exact same home life in Repo Man. I just thought that was really bizarre.
Well, it's that era. That was the basic representation of a dysfunctional family in that era.
Yeah.
You know, the middle class, angry dad who's home from work and yelling at his son, and the mom kind of standing up for him but disappointed, and things aren't connecting and gelling, and that's very much a trope of the time.
And punk music underscoring both scenes for sure.
Oh yeah.
But the great thing about this particular segment is, of course, the Bishop of Battle itself, which is, and again, when I talk about this thematic plagiarizing that's going on, this is like punk rock Tron is what we're watching in this particular vignette. And what I think is great is that you just have this big floating polygonal face that is the Bishop of Battle itself, in this very adversarial but very even-keeled line delivery that this character has. By the way, I didn't realize until this viewing, I had to look it up, the voice of the Bishop itself is another, again, a character actor that that most people probably...
You all know.
Yeah, you've got to know at this point.
He's in Back to the Future.
He's in Back to the Future. He plays Principal Strickland. He's also... James Tolkien is that actor's name. He's also in Masters of the Universe.
Oh, yeah.
Playing almost the exact same character as he plays in Back to the Future. But yeah, it's again, just character actors showing up everywhere, even when they're not actually on screen, is pretty outstanding. So,
even in the scenes here, Moon Unit Zappa is one of the little girls running around in the arcade.
Why not? Moon Unit Zappa, sure. She's there. That's so bizarre. But yeah, I think the big draw of this particular vignette is just sort of the, it probably seems hokey now by today's standards, but the scene where all of the elements of the game have broken loose into the arcade and he's having to fight them off, and it's, you know, blowing up things. The pinball machines are blowing up. He's diving over, you know, asteroid cabinets and, you know, just firing back with this this gun that has actually ripped off the console of the Bishop of Battle game. And it's just, it's so much fun to watch. And even as silly a premise as someone who's obsessed with a video game may seem, Estevez really goes for it, like really just buys into it, and is such a raving dickhead to people when he doesn't get his way about playing this game, and that it sells it, and it sells it pretty well. And then you just have this really fun experience, much like, you know, when you're watching Tron, although not quite to that level. Of that level of quality of effects, I mean, of just watching someone take on the elements of a video game in the real world, or make the playing field of a video game more like the playing field of a tangible world. And I think that's what makes this segment so much fun.
It is. Although I would like to highlight this has the only cultural moment in the movie that you have to kind of cover your eyes and just hold your tongue and just let it pass. But this has one of the worst Mexican-American representations I've seen in a while.
Hairnet on, the plaid shirt that's only top two buttoned over a white wife beater.
And I get, like, that was the fashion of the time. That I can forgive. The fact that if you play a drinking game where you take a drink every time someone says the word essay, you would be dead. It's just like they can't get a sentence out of their mouth without the word essay. And it's just like, Oh, man. Oh, no.
There are more essays in this film than in an AP literature class. It is ridiculous how many times that guy... Like, at one point during the movie, I turned to Clark and I was like, he needs to stop saying essay. Tell him to stop saying essay immediately.
And the thing was, I was already sitting there going, let's get past the stereotypes, please. And you're just like, he needs to stop.
And he said it like four more times after I said that. And I had let it go for a while. And I was like, no, he really needs to stop saying essay. And my favorite part of that is at one point, Emilio Estevez says totally. He says it one time. And they make fun of him for. They're like, totally. And I'm like, really? You're going to make fun of his lingo?
Well, I just
are you
love,
serious?
I love how here we have, you know, we have a Latino actor playing the white boy in a scene opposite these stereotypes, and they're making fun of him for being white, and that's not actually the context of what's going on. It's just the reality of it. The reality of it is far more PC than than what they're portraying on the screen.
Yeah.
It's an awkward moment, but it's otherwise it's an interesting scene because it's essentially, you know, it's the hustler, you know.
Yeah.
It is watching this kid hustle these people he should not be hustling so that he can get money to go play Bishop of Battle.
Yeah. And I think the problem is that nobody told all the Hispanic actors on set that no, this one didn't change his name to Sheen. He's still an Estevez, so yeah. Lay off a little bit. Again, I want to talk a little bit to Emilio Estevez's commitment to this vignette. He actually went through 2 weeks of NYPD gun training so that in his segment, which by the way, he's firing a laser gun from a video game, so I'm not sure how much like a police officer he really needed to look, but that he was committed and went through this 2-week training course with the NYPD on gun use. So silly as it may seem, once again, Estevez committing full on. Which brings us to the third vignette, which is, I think, both of our favorites.
Yeah. This is the one that you take this out of context and show it to anyone, and they'll just dig it and think it's great because it's legitimately awesome.
And I think it has the most substance of any of the four of these movies.
Absolutely.
It feels like it has more weight to it. The characters feel more developed, more well-rounded, and frankly... It doesn't feel like it's leading up to a punchline the way that every other segment does. It doesn't feel like it's got that sort of one-note Twilight Zone-y, like we're just waiting for the catch at the end. It's you're watching a character go through something and you legitimately don't know where it's going or how he's or what his, you know, outcome is going to be.
Yeah, well, and the thing, one of the other things that separates us from the other ones, the other films, is this character's flaw, the morality play in this one at play is not the kind of flaw that you dislike them for, that they're being punished for.
There's nothing outwardly reproachful about his transgression, I guess.
This is the story.
It's called The Benediction.
The Benediction. Lance Henriksen plays a priest who recently, a small child that's part of his parish has died in a liquor store robbery or a grocery store robbery and was shot, and he's lost his faith. All he sees is evil and anarchy in the world. And at the funeral, he breaks down and he can't do it anymore. And the well is dry, as he says, and he can't be a priest anymore and he has to leave. And so he leaves his parish to just drive and see where he ends up and get a job somewhere.
Very kung fu. Just wander the earth.
Yeah, he just wants to wander the earth. He just wants to go out and find a nice, quiet place to live, but he cannot preach anymore because it's just not in him.
So this is how our story begins, and as he's out on the road, he has a very, very awkward run-in with a pickup truck, all black tinted windows, at a two-way stop where he starts to go. It is his right of way, but then the other truck peels off. Nothing much to make of that until he keeps seeing this truck reappear and at one point tries to run him over as he's changing a tire. Suddenly this becomes
a big black truck with tinted windows.
Yeah.
That sounds oddly familiar.
It does. It does actually. This is essentially the Duel, which was one of Steven Spielberg's first movies, which is absolutely fantastic if you haven't seen it.
Yeah, Duel's amazing.
Highly, highly, highly recommend it. And I know this obviously didn't pull from this movie I'm about to mention because this movie came out, you know, several years later. But if you mixed Duel with Tremors, that would be kind of where the third act of this vignette goes, as this truck is so prevalent and so dead set on destroying our main character that at one point it literally burrows out from under the ground and and one of the best effects in the movie.
Yeah.
Of just watching this mound of dirt start rolling along and then actually watch the truck as if they built a ramp underground just burst out of the earth and come after him again.
Yeah, like, when it happened, I was like, oh, that's just Chuck Norris driving that truck.
Womp, womp.
For those of you that have seen Lone Wolf McQuade, the amazing, amazing Lone Wolf McQuade.
Donald Trump's favorite movie, Lone Wolf McQuade.
That is something I wouldn't doubt. Are you kidding me? That movie is conservative as hell.
Yeah.
It's a beer-drinking slob with a American flag hanging outside his house that makes fun of Hispanics and lives in Texas and hits all the checks off all the cliche boxes. It's wonderful. I adore that movie. you see Tremors out of that one little bit, but I can't help but think that this is Duel meets The Exorcist.
Oh, yeah.
With Lance Henriksen.
Yeah, because that truck is 100%. Oh, you know what? You know what this is? This is Duel meets the car. Because the car is also about
it's a representation of evil.
A vehicle that represents essentially the
devil.
That's
what I thought you loved about this particular segment was because I was like, because we were talking about it, and I was like, oh, yeah, Brian has a mad love for the car. The car is about the car driving around the desert killing people, and this is Lance Henriksen driving around the desert being chased by the truck instead of the car.
And even from the rearview mirror has an upside-down crucifix hanging from it, even though we never see the driver, which is fantastic. And, of course, the only way, and this is where the element of faith comes back in, the only way he can defeat this truck is there's a great scene earlier on when he's about to hit the road.
Which has my favorite line of dialogue from this movie. It's the only bit of dialogue from the movie that I remembered.
Here, I'll give you the lead-in line, and you give me Lance Henriksen's. And the lead-in line from the other priest is, wait, you can't take that. That's holy water.
It's tap water, and I need it.
Yes, exactly. He takes what looks like a gasoline can full of
holy
water.
It's an old thermos. One of those big like Coleman water cooler things. And he's like, it's tap water. It's holy water. You can't take it. He's like, it's tap water.
But holy water has become so devalued to a man without faith that it's just water.
It's just tap water.
But then, of course, at the end, turns out to be his deus ex machina for getting rid of Diablo ex truckina. So yeah,
it's Diablo ex truckina.
I don't know. I don't speak Spanish.
I have no idea. That is it's the best Spanish I think you've ever spoken.
Sí. But yeah, the benediction has some of the, like, just it, the tension is so much more, it's the most exciting segment by far.
Oh yeah.
It's got like
very well shot.
Yeah. Very well shot. It's got the most depth of character. It plays around with chronology. We see him driving. We see him flashing back to things that happened while he was a priest. I mean, it's just really the most, like, I was surprised to learn that the first three segments were all written by the same person and the fourth was written by someone else. I would have been far less surprised to hear that 1, 2, and 4 were written by the same person and 3 was written by a separate writer because it feels so different from the other three.
Yeah, but the morality play in the fourth one is so radically different from the others.
True.
That makes sense to me. But yeah, what I love about this is, I mean, this entire segment, like all of the segments are very much about their endings,
mm-hmm.
as a good short film should be. But this particular ending is just so good because it really is this entire short is about a guy who's lost his faith and is confronted by a manifestation of evil. And that manifestation of evil is the proof he needs that there is a God.
Right, because at one point during this segment, he says something about believing that there's really no such thing as good or evil. Like, he can't really distinguish between the two, which is so much more complex than the idea of, oh, I don't believe in God anymore. It's just, I don't believe that good and evil are really any different. Like, I can't distinguish between the two of them. I think it's just so much more interesting narratively than, oh, I just don't believe in God anymore. Like, I think it's the far more interesting choice.
Yeah, no, and that's what's so fascinating about this is it is the deepest segment and the strongest segment and the one that I think really truly holds up. Like, the other three segments are all dated in some way, shape, or form, mm-hmm. to where there's stuff you have to forgive.
Yeah,
like those big expensive special effects in the second one aren't so impressive, and you look at that and you're like, this video game, this whole segment is about a video game, and the video game doesn't make any fucking sense. Like,
yeah.
Like, what is the point of this video game? It's like, how is it supposed to work? I don't get it.
Well, and the first one too is self-service or full-service gas stations aren't really a thing anymore. So no. that urban legend kind of gets corrupted by the fact that you really don't have those anymore. And then, of course, the fourth one has some special effects that are probably the most dated of anything in this movie.
Oh, it has one of the worst special effects I've ever seen.
It was dated for its time, and we'll get to that in a second. Yes. But you're right. This Benediction, you could watch today, and it's just as effective. And there's and I think part of that is because it takes place in an area of the country that, even for 1983, already feels like it's out of time. It's anachronistic. Yeah. And so it's not a far cry to leap that forward a couple of generations and it still feel like that.
But it's just such a classic good tale.
Yeah.
And it's properly executed the entire way through.
For sure.
So it is, hands down, if you only watch one of these, if you start watching this and you get through the first segment and you're like, why did I decide to watch? Why did I listen to these guys? Skip ahead to the Benediction and watch the Benediction.
If you're having a crisis of faith in us from the first two vignettes, it will be restored by the time you get to the Benediction.
And fucking Lance Henriksen, for
plus fucking
sake.
Lance Henriksen. Come on, guys. Come on.
Yeah. One of two character actors in this movie that come from the Aliens franchise.
That's true. And we're going to move on now to the fourth segment, which has, of course, the second person from an Alien film. This one, enigmatically, is called Night of the Rat.
Why is it called Night of the Rat?
Because it has a giant rat, and it takes place mostly at night.
Oh my God.
Twist.
Yeah, no, like it's...
See if you can spot the subtlety of that.
Yeah, no, it's like... Terror and Topanga is like that classic kind of 1950s, like grisly, salacious, you know,
drive-in title.
Yeah, drive-in title or book title. And then you've got Bishop of Battle, which is so 1980s.
Yeah.
It's so cutting edge, and it's the name of the video game.
You know you're ready for something hardcore and action-packed.
And then there's The Benediction, which is very mysterious. 70s. And then we get Night of the Rat.
And then Night of the Rat.
It's just kind of like, okay, it's Night of the Rat. And the reason we bring this up is because we spent so much time just kind of joking about it during the segment. As the movie would cut away and show us a different time of day, it would be mid-morning of the rat.
Yeah, it's like, it's amazing how much the Night of the Rat doesn't take place at night.
Late afternoon of the rat. And then we got the Twilight of the Rat, which actually sounded like a cool title, and we didn't find it very funny.
No, we kind of lost.
And then it got into night, and the rat showed up, and we're like, oh, okay, yeah, lived up to its name.
You know what kills me about this title is that Peter Weller's, same year, 1983, Peter Weller's rat movie has a better, more interesting title of Unknown Origin. And it came out the same year. Was that the problem? There was a quota, there was like a cap on how many interestingly titled giant rat movies could come out in 1 year? I don't know. Maybe so. This one actually stars Richard Mazur, who many of you might know from The Thing. Yeah. As the guy who tended to the dogs. It's actually probably, he's one of my favorite characters in The Thing. It's a great movie, great ensemble cast. He's a fantastic part of that. And then, of course, Veronica Cartwright, who we were mentioning, is the cast member from Alien. And then you were mentioning that the little girl in this segment is played by Bridget Anderson.
Yeah, she's one of those famous morality tales of my generation, in that, you know, she...
Odd that she would appear in this anthology, yeah. And then she herself is a morality
tale.
Yeah,
she was... She was part of that young actress set that came up with, that was the exact same age as Drew Barrymore, and I'm blanking on her name, the little girl from Poltergeist.
Oh, Heather O'Rourke?
Yeah, Heather O'Rourke. Like, in this era of movies, if there was a little girl, an adorable little girl in the movie, it was one of those three girls.
Right.
And this is the girl who was in Savannah Smiles. And she would end up being in stuff all through the 80s and into the 90s. And then when she's like 21 years old in the late 90s, overdosed on drugs. And it's a very sad story. But here she's doing what she does best in this era, which apparently, according to your rules, I can say is be hot and wander around as a 7-year-old.
They're not my rules. Not my rules. I learned them.
She's the adorable little girl who's, you know, looking for her cat. And her cat has gone missing.
Yeah.
And where's my cat, mommy? And something terrible has happened to the cat.
This it's about a very middle-class family with a very overbearing father played by Richard Mazur. Who...
The pinnacle of baby boomerness.
Yes, absolutely.
He is the greedy, cheap baby boomer. He is the embodiment of what was happening at this time in the 80s, which is what this is. This movie is a, you know, the morality tale here is the reflection of what we were becoming. It was taking the cheapness of the 60s and the 70s of people who had grown up, you know, very
self-reliant.
Yeah, very self-reliant, very frugal. Mixing with being in big business, and we get that big business scene of him on the phone, and he's a doer, and he's doing, you know, work at home, and
he fires a guy whose wife is expecting a baby. That's like his Ebenezer Scrooge moment that we overhear him on the phone.
Yeah, and because he was the best salesman, but he's not living up anymore, and now he's got to go.
Yeah,
because, you know, and he spits out a bunch of 80s-isms. Is essentially just the exact type of douchebag that people are talking about in politics right now. Like, this is like, this guy is the prototype that everything that's wrong with Wall Street was built upon. And he refuses to do little things around the house that need being done.
He refuses. Yeah. But he also refuses to let his wife pay anyone to do those things because it's like, oh, everyone's just got their hand out. I mean, which is an odd, to me, it's an odd perspective to take on, you know, if you're a well-to-do family and you're not doing things around your house yourself, to look at any service industry as people with their hands out is like next level conservative nonsense to me.
Well, that's what the key to this character is, and what's so detestable about him is that he's all about making money and not about spending it and recontributing it to the economy. It's all about, you know, making it to make it and about getting forward and being a doer and being a guy who finishes things, but not actually, you know, doing it. And that's what the character depth of him is fantastic. He's detestable and you just want to punch this dude in the face. But his wife is also kind of a jackass.
Yeah. Yeah. Just, and I think you were right as we were watching this and saying, yeah, I don't like either of these characters, because it's true. You really don't. Like, they have these exchanges that I think were clearly written to present the wife as sort of this unfortunate character that you're supposed to empathize with. Like, it's clear that that's how it was written. Not really how it comes across in the execution.
Yeah.
It just comes across as an overbearing asshole of a husband and a completely milquetoast, weak, ineffectual...
frigid wife.
Yeah, yeah. It's neither one of them come off especially well. And then creeping into their perfect suburban existence is, I mean, like the most classic representation of you know, something that destroys a happy... It's a rat, right? But it happens to be not just a rat, but a German... I'm not even going to try and pronounce the actual word, but a demon rodent is the translation.
So according to the legend, das Teufelnagetier cannot be destroyed.
That is attracted to characters without a lot of character, or people without a lot of character. It's attracted to those who have kind of... lost their way. And in this case, that's Richard Mazur. What I like about this particular vignette, and it's right up until the end, they make the decision not to really show the rat. And what they get from that, and maybe, I mean, you could chalk that up to budget, you can chalk it up to whatever you want, but up until they actually kind of blow their wad by showing it and it's not very good, it has this sort of like Jaws quality where it's like you see the destruction, you see these measuring sticks to tell us how big this thing is, and it's unsettling.
And it goes from Jaws to Jeepers Creepers.
It goes from Jaws to Food of the Gods really quickly. And that's, it actually feels a lot like any given Burt I. Gordon movie, in that the effect of the giant creature, the giant animal, is just he filmed that animal and then projected the image of it a little bit bigger into the film so that it looks giant but is not actually interacting with anything in the room because it's not really there. I mean, that's exactly what they did for Food of the Gods, what they did for, I think it was called Empire of the Ants. I mean, any given Burt I. Gordon movie is exactly the same. And that is really unfortunate because I think they had something cool going for them. But then once you see it, it's just like, oh, man. Oh, this is just not good. And they keep showing it. And what's crazy about it is it, because they've assigned now supernatural qualities, it's not just a giant rat, but it's some sort of supernatural fabled story rat. The movie becomes, you know, again, with the whole plagiarism theme, becomes Poltergeist. It's like doors are moving on their own, and it's like, and to the point that she's even screaming, Steven, and you hear like the little girl's in peril, doors are slamming on their own, beds are flying up and down, she's screaming, Steven, you know, save our daughter, and you just feel very Poltergeist-like as you're watching.
It's very
this.
Poltergeist, except rather than liking the family and feeling for the family, you hate the family.
Yeah, they didn't earn it.
But the thing is you do connect with the little girl, and the little girl's the one they put in peril.
Yes.
And that's the interesting thing, that what this film does is that it really does that ending, and the buildup of the mythology really makes it function. Like there's a moment where, I mean, there's a moment you just want to punch the dad in the face in this.
Oh, for
like,
sure.
Like where there's literally a gargantuan hole in the wall covered in green slime with a huge trail of rat hair. And metal pipes bit through, and he's like, no, I'll do it myself. And it's like, asshole, like no person in their right mind does that. What the fuck are you doing? You clearly have a problem too large for a normal exterminator, for fuck's sake.
Yeah.
Stop being
on,
a jackass.
Man.
I want to hit you. I've gone from disliking
you
to I want to hit you.
Hey,
come out of the movie screen so I can hit you, please.
Sorry, Richard Mazur, this is just how we feel.
To his credit, he's so likable in so many other films.
That's true.
No, he's such a great character actor. No, this is the only time I think I've ever wanted to hit Richard Mazur. I can't remember another role of his where I was just like, oh, I hate him. But in this one, when he does that, when he's like, no, get out of my house, I'll fix it myself, but it's like, dude,
yeah, come on.
Like that's not just being cheap, that's being unrealistic.
Very much so.
But yeah, so you get to that ending and it's literally one of the worst effects I've ever seen in a mainstream movie. Like it is one of those where it's so laughably bad that you really laugh at it until you start feeling really awful for laughing because you really like so much of this movie and you're just like, this movie deserves better than this. Oh, and yeah. Now I feel bad.
So maybe this is my least favorite. I don't know. Yeah, I guess it is. I guess if I had to, my personal ranking from best to worst of vignettes in this, and I like doing this with every anthology movie I watch, would be Benediction, Bishop of Battle, Terror and Topanga, and then
3-2-1-4.
Yeah, 3-2-1-4.
I would probably go the same. Probably would. The sad thing is it's just the only thing wrong with that final segment is just how over the top they go with his character and the goofiness of
the rat itself.
Because what ends up happening is, you know, the rat communicates with the little girl. It's like, she just wants the baby. And you find out this big rat they killed in their attic wasn't a big rat. It was a baby rat of this thing.
Yeah.
And the way they actually, as bad as the effect looks, the way they shoot the rat at the end and the way it's gently nuzzling its baby is genuinely kind of sad.
Yeah.
And effective and works.
Which feels like an accident, by the way. It feels like they just were shooting so much stock of that rat that eventually it did something that worked.
Which is how you deal with those kind of animals, but oftentimes. But what ruins it is the little nudge right there at the end, mm-hmm. where they, you know, it runs out the window and the little girl goes, "Where's it gonna go next, Daddy?" as the camera trails over the city and then the credits roll. It's yeah. like, it's headed to your house, but, children.
And which would, I think, would still work effectively if we got any kind of sense that the dad in this vignette learned anything at all. Like, I don't feel like there's any change in his character.
Because we never really get to that point. We really do leave after the denouement.
They betray
before,
that.
We leave before the denouement that right. would, like, we have that moment. But then again, I feel like we don't really need that here because we've literally, so going back through this, the end of the first segment ends with, "I've learned my lesson. I've thrown away my cigarettes. I've just had a killer in my backseat, watch him get shot, and I've decided tonight's the night I'm going to quit smoking." First of all, that would never fucking happen. Two, the more realistic ending, Emilio Estevez gets sucked into a video game.
Yes. yes.
Slightly more realistic than giving up smoking on the scariest night of your fucking life. But yeah, he gets sucked into the video game because his arrogance and his addiction lead to his destruction. And then, of course, the end of the
benediction.
The benediction is Lance Henriksen deciding to go back
to his parish,
and the way it's written is just so great because it's you know exactly what's going to happen without them saying, "I'm going to go back and become a priest again." So you have all of these great denouement moments where you learn the ultimate fate of your character. And this one, it's like, anything where we find out who he has become, anything that he's learned is just going to feel forced.
Yeah.
Like we barely get away with it in the end of the first segment. The other two segments work perfectly.
Yeah.
The Bishop of Battle and the Benediction, both those endings are perfect denouements. And it's just a little bit, I think if they actually did the denouement that we're talking about them having to have to resolve his character, we would just wish the movie would end.
That's probably
and
true.
So it ends right with the big climax and we go off and she goes, "Where's it going now, Daddy?" And dun, dun, dun.
over to Craig T. Nelson's house.
Yeah.
That's where it's headed.
We're going over to Cat's Eye.
Oh, no.
Nightmares. They don't only happen at night.
So that brings us to the junk food pairing for this week. And again, this particular junk food, I think, could be an apt pairing for any anthology film, again, with just the mixed bag of quality and of effect that is an anthology horror film. So I went with Gardetto's, with its mix of, you know, the breadsticks and the pretzels and those little garlic rye chips that I love so much that I actually buy them separately. So for me, the roasted garlic rye chip of this movie is the benediction.
You can actually buy those separately?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I will pig out on those. I love those.
You are all
things.
About the benediction chips?
I'm all about those benediction. The body of Christ. That's my body of Christ are the garlic rye chips from the Gardetto's. But again, if you don't like the pretzels, eat around them and just eat the breadsticks. If you don't like Terra Tabanga,
breadsticks are the hard body of Christ.
There you go. And if you want to eat around, if you want to, you know, go around Terra and Topanga, there's still Bishop of Battle. If you don't like Night of the Rat, there's still the Benediction. Very much a mixed bag of a movie, much like Gardetto's are a very satisfying mix, but sometimes you just want to pick out your favorites, and that's okay too. You can enjoy anthology movies that way. No one's going to judge you. Hey, thank you so much for joining us this week on Junk Food Cinema. I hope you've enjoyed our discussion of Nightmares. If you would like to follow us further, you can listen to back cataloged episodes on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema or like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. Cargo, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me on Twitter at Massaworm, MassaWyrm, or on Facebook at facebook.com/massaworm.
Excellent. You can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury. You can also follow me, or you can like my page on Facebook, facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic. So, guys, definitely just remember that no matter what happens, no matter what you hear, that kid in Jersey who says he's listened to 13 hours of Junk Food Cinema, that's just a myth. Nobody can do that. It is progressively more difficult to sit through each new episode.